Hello, and welcome to Fade Out, the podcast that examines the final films of Hollywood's brightest lights. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly. Our subject this month is dancer-actor Juliette Prowse. Born in 1936 in Bombay, British India, the young Juliette started learning to dance at the age of four. While performing at a club in Paris, a talent agent spotted her, and she was eventually cast in 1960's Can-Can, starring Frank Sinatra and Shirley MacLaine. During the filming of the movie, Nikita Khrushchev, during his first visit to America, was given a tour of the production. When he saw Prowse perform a saucy version of the titular dance, Khrushchev declared it immoral, putting Prowse's name in newspapers across the country. Time magazine gave the movie a bad review, but stated that Prowse is the best thing in it. She then co-starred with Elvis Presley in 1960's G.I. Blues, which was a big hit. She followed that with the 1961 adventure film The Fiercest Heart, and then came the drama The Right Approach. She took a supporting part in the Debbie Reynolds Western comedy The Second Time Around, following that with a small appearance in the Italian comedy Run for Your Wife, and then the courtroom drama Dingaka, set in South Africa during apartheid. Prowse then appeared in 1965's Who Killed Teddy Bear, co-starring Sal Mineo and Jan Murray. The gritty black-and-white thriller deals with such taboo subjects as homosexuality, pornography, voyeurism, and incest, and it would end up being her last film. While Prowse continued to have a very successful career on TV and the stage, she never appeared on the silver screen again. Here with me to discuss Who Killed Teddy Bear and the career of Juliette Prowse is the author of the new book, Juliette Prowse, Born to Dance, her niece and namesake, Juliette Prowse. Hi, Juliette.
Hi, thank you for having me on your show.
Absolutely. This was a fascinating experience for me to go through. We're going to start kind of at the ending, in that when I was a kid, I knew who Juliette Prowse was through one main credit, and that was her appearance on The Muppet Show, because yeah. I was 5 or 6 when that show debuted. And, you know, when you're a kid like that, you're sort of like, well, anyone who hosts The Muppet Show, that's a famous person. I don't know who they are, but that's a famous person. And so in my mind, Juliette Prowse was always just she's a famous person because she was on The Muppet Show. She was one of the, you know, one of the coolest people on the planet, because The Muppet Show had the coolest hosts then, you know, Debbie Harry and Vincent Price and Mikhail Baryshnikov and Juliette Prowse. And not only is Juliette Prowse was a host on The Muppet Show, she was a host on the very first episode of The Muppet Show, yeah. Which is amazing, right? And we will talk about that later on, but it was a fascinating thing to go back through her film career, such as it was, and see what choices she made, and then the Who Killed Teddy Bear, which is an incredible right turn. But I want to start off with your experiences with her as her niece. When did you come along, and where was she in her career when you were born and when you got to kind of figure out who your aunt was?
Yes. So interestingly, she's Juliette Prowse. I was named after her, so I'm Juliette Prowse. And she's 31 years older than me. We were almost born on the same day. We're 2 days apart. My only aunt. So I had this connection with her my whole life. And the interesting thing was she was, her career really blew up like in the media from about 1960. And mm-hmm. and she was helped by her association as in romances with Frank Sinatra and Elvis Presley. So from the 1960s, she was in the media a lot in South Africa and in the U.S. How I got to see all of this stuff is, this is how the book started, was in my parents' attic was a suitcase, a little red suitcase filled with newspaper articles. And when I started going through those, Juliette had sent them to my grandmother who lived next door to us. When I went through those, I thought there's a book in this, but it also explains her popularity or her visibility amongst many older fans. So you ask, how did I first become aware? So I'm like a young child in the 70s. And if I said my name, in public somewhere, I would often get the, isn't there a famous person by that name? Isn't there a famous actress by that name? And I must tell you, because she's well known in South Africa, she was kind of known as the South African girl who made it in Hollywood. Mm. I still get it. I mean, she died in 1996, so we're coming up to almost 30 years ago, and I'll still be somewhere random and get that association. So she was, so that was that association with me as a child. She only had one brother, my father, and my grandmother, who she ended up in South Africa because her family, her father died in India in 1940. So then they came to South Africa. But her parents lived here. So she, Juliet, would come back to South Africa fairly often to be, come on holiday and come see her family. And that's when we got to know her as a character. She was a real character as an aunt. She was fun loving. She's comedic. And we thoroughly enjoyed being on holiday with her in South Africa. I inherited some of her athleticism. I'm definitely not a dancer, not graceful, and can't even splits properly. But I ended up getting a running scholarship from the University of Nebraska. And so Juliet lived in LA, so I flew from South Africa and stayed with her for 2 weeks. And so I got to know her as a young adult, shall we say. She died when I was 29, but I got to know her over those sort of 5 years when I was at Nebraska. And so that was lovely. So I've thoroughly enjoyed documenting her life. I'll just show, sort of put it up there. That's her book. And actually thoroughly enjoyed going through the newspaper articles. There ended up being a box of 640 letters that were in a garage in Las Vegas. Her last boyfriend had the letters, but he didn't let us know until I went came to the US in 2022. And so that also forms part of the source material. And it was wonderful to read her words. And you ask how I knew her well, but you don't really know, you know. If a person's 31 years older than you don't know what they were like as a 25-year-old, and
Sure.
you know all the thoughts she was going through when she started dating Frank Sinatra and got engaged to him and things like that. So yeah, that's it's been a lovely journey with her, like a second time round, shall we say, in writing the book.
I generally don't on this show ever bother with the personal lives of the people we're talking about, because I always feel like it's really not anybody's business, not my business. It's not really relevant to the work for the most part. Occasionally it'll kind of bleed in. But when I read that she had had relationships, public relationships, with both, as you just mentioned, Frank Sinatra and Elvis Presley, it certainly gives you a view of the person that, okay, this was not a shrinking violet, this person that was able to have relationships with those two guys. I mean, I would say anyone who has the ability to have a relationship with one of them tells you something about how strong of spine they must have been, let alone both of them. That's pretty amazing. So when you were a younger, when you're a kid and you're coming up, did she talk about her career? Did it ever come? Did it ever kind of, was it always just that's your aunt? Or was it, oh, I saw Auntie Juliet on TV the other day, or I saw one of her movies playing. Did it bleed over? Did she talk about it a whole lot, or was it just sort of a separate thing?
Well, there were a couple of things in that. Obviously, South Africa, it was in apartheid era, and we didn't have television until about 1976.
Wow.
So that was one thing where we didn't just see her on her TV shows or on a variety show. She was on a lot of variety shows. That was the other thing that helped her visibility. She was at the end, by the end of the career, she'd been on over about 100 variety and game shows. And especially in the 1960s, there were lots of, that was kind of like, there were a lot of game shows. So firstly, we didn't see a lot of stuff. And then secondly, she was very, very down to earth. And when she came to South Africa, she was just Juliet. And my mom even said that I think we hadn't realized quite how famous she was, until I started researching, and it was things like, she has one son called Seth, and she was pregnant with him, and decided to get married when she was heavily pregnant. This was her second marriage, and she actually didn't want to get married, and then decided last minute. And anyway, she was on Lake Tahoe in a boat, and went into labor. So
How?
Tim, when I tell the story, I go, "That's just so typically Julia, too
Wow.
enthusiastic, thought it would all be okay." But it's going through these newspaper articles. She's on the front page of the LA Times, the top banner. Basically, I think it says "Baby Balks Juliet's Wedding" or something like that. And I looked at that and I thought, my God, you mean the my cousin's birth is like the, when you see the newspapers in a stack, she's on the top. I was like, okay, all right, now I'm understanding her levels. But no, she was a very, very down to earth, and that's, even amongst her dancers and amongst, I know there was a documentary done about her, a South African documentary in the 80s, and Rock Hudson had said she really could act more like a star, but she didn't really, as in maybe she did, that was just wasn't that important to her. I think doing good work and working with her dancers and choreographers, I think that's what she loved the most, and dancing, really, when it came down to it.
Okay, so that actually leads to something that I have here in my notes I wanted to ask you about, because around this time last year on the show, I had my guest was Barry Chase, the legendary dancer who is luckily still with us in her 90s, and I got to talk to her about being in White Christmas and It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, two of my all-time favorite movies. And that was a fascinating discussion because often dancers that become actors, some of them are dancers who want to become actors and they use the dancing to get into acting. And then others are dancers that sort of fall into acting and are sort of like, well, acting is okay, that's nice, but dancing is more my art form. What was your sense of that? Was that I get the sense from the reading I did on her and watching her movies and stuff that outside of like she kind of really thought of herself more as a dancer who acted, or is that not correct?
I would say that she started as a ballet dancer. She was trained, and actually originally as a teenager, she went to London. She wanted to be further her career in ballet, but she was too tall, and then got more opportunities, or she in modern dance. I think in her heart of hearts, she is really a dancer, but reading your letters, there was disappointment maybe in her film career, or her screen career rather than her stage career. I think she had a little bit of conflict where actually she loved being on stage, and she loved the interaction with the audience and the immediate feedback that you get. And she loved the whole collaboration with the cast and crew. But somewhere she also wanted to try and do well as an actress. I mean, the other TV show that she was on, she got onto, she got a part in a show called Mona McCluskey
Mona
in the 90s.
McCluskey, right?
And it went to 26 episodes and wasn't renewed for the next season. And even though she sort of said she was fine with that, her secretary wrote to my grandmother and said she could see the impact that it had. So I think actually she was a dancer, and she loved dancing, and she loved stage and live theatre definitely more. But so part of her ambitious side actually wanted to also establish herself as an actress. But I actually think if she could have just done shows on Broadway that were more ideal at showcasing her as a dancer, that would have been better for her than specifically making it as a dramatic actress.
Okay.
Yeah,
Because I'm looking
and
at her. Or, I'm sorry, go ahead.
she wasn't trained as an actor. She was trained as a dancer, and she was, trained sort of on the job training, shall we say, in musical theatre, or in ballet productions, which led to musical theatre.
Because I'm looking at, her filmography, and after she does Can-Can, she does G.I. Blues, which she dances in both. Then she does these two movies, The Fiercest Heart and The Right Approach. The two movies, and we talked about this before off air, is they are impossible to find. The Right Approach was put on DVD, but that DVD is long out of print, and I was not able to get a copy of it before we recorded this. And The Fiercest Heart is just completely unavailable. It's not streaming. It was never put on any home video, as far as I could find. And it's just like a lost movie at this point. So I didn't see either one of those. Have you seen those films?
I haven't managed to find them,
That
so I
wow. That
sort
see,
of
that's how hard they are to find.
yes.
So I don't know if she dances in those. I don't get the sense that she does from
No,
the plot.
she
She
doesn't.
doesn't. Okay.
Yeah.
So after Can Can G.I. Blues, basically the rest of her film career, she doesn't dance. The second time around, she doesn't dance. Run for Your Wife, Dingaka, and then Who Killed Teddy Bear? And so I thought, well, that was interesting that she made this turn to where, and then after she's kind of done her film career, she goes, as you talk about, goes back to the stage and back to television and does a lot of dancing. And so
Yes.
I always find that kind of curious. It's like, oh, she almost sort of tried it. And I have to wonder if it was just a case in her of her of she came along at a time where the musical had
Yes.
just died as a genre, because the 50s was there were a lot of great musicals, and then the 70s they kind of came back as a kind of metatextual thing where you had these sort of like Cabaret and New York, New York, and all that jazz, which were sort of musicals commenting on the form. But she was already out of movies by then. But so her time was the 60s when they really weren't producing very many musicals. And I wonder if just she just came along at just not the right time to find the right dance project for her.
I think that's exactly right. I read a comment. I read Bob Fosse, the choreographer's. Well, actually, it wasn't. Yeah, it was a book written about him, An American Dance. And Bob Fosse had said in 1951, which I think was actually quite early, that the door was closing on him and the musical. And I mean, Juliet actually only got to Hollywood at the end, at sort of mid 1959, and so all those big musicals that were done. And we will get to your question of, well, you know, what I would have liked to have seen it, but what, you know, there were these amazing musicals done in the 1950s, and they just, I mean, you still had a few, you know, in the 60s, but I think the studios, they weren't producing them at not nearly at the same rate. And then, you know, we're looking. I realized also in writing the book, and this wasn't just the film studios that were, well, you know, they were adapting within the decade of the 60s, but Broadway had to adapt as well. So because they were, especially in the US, it was so tumultuous with the sexual revolution, human rights protests, and then Vietnam War protests. Quite a lot of what had been, you know, sort of very sweet and wholesome and fun musicals of the 50s were actually just now irrelevant and out of touch with society. And Broadway struggled as well, but that really was her thing. She if she had been born maybe I'd say, well, it's interesting because I've been looking at some of Gene Kelly's movies, and one of them that we'll talk about later, but it's got Leslie Caron in it as a 19-year-old, and Leslie Caron is 5 years older than Juliet. And I thought, it's not just that Leslie Caron is 5 years older than Juliet, it's that she also was living in Europe and Juliet was living in South Africa. So she had to sort of chart this path of getting to Europe and getting, you know, working with some good people and having the right connections to for her to get over to the US and to get recommended just in Can-Can. It was actually Hermes Pan, so Fred Astaire's choreographer that saw Juliet, and you need those kind of connections to be recommended. And yes, Juliet did kind of benefit from Barry Chase, or Chase Barry not working out in Can-Can. So that Juliet took over the role that she had as the principal dancer in Can-Can.
Oh, I don't think I didn't know that.
Yes. So there was some, I sort of reading between the lines as to what conflict there was in Can-Can, but initially they were interested in her. But she didn't get the role, and then got sort of like I think a telegram in those days. You know, if you can get yourself, if you can, you know, if you can sign it, you must sign a 7-year contract. She did not want it. given your contract.
Hmm.
And get yourself to the US as soon as possible because you've started filming already, you know. And how Juliet ended up in the US, and she was then already 23.
Yeah,
Yes.
so many of the episodes I do are, are on older stars, and so many of their stories are they were working out of this and they got seen by somebody and 2 years later they're in movies. You know, it's like that's not the way it works
Yeah.
nowadays. But back then it was like you just some random person saw you and you could make that connection and boom, all of a sudden you're in Hollywood with, as you say, with a 7 year contract and you're doing movies. It's kind of amazing.
Yes. The reality, though, just also on Juliet's career, what's sort of impacted on it, besides, so she does Can-Can, she does GI Blues, and she's sort of flying high, and then she's waiting for good opportunities. But they didn't really come around. And she was frustrated, and she got these sort of average roles, and she got more and more frustrated with 20th Century Fox, partly because the roles were quite average, and then partly because she was getting asked to do sort of Broadway roles in Vegas or different productions on stage, and that was a conflict for obviously a film studio, and they kept saying to her, "Is this good? Is this right for you? Is this good for your career?" And she just sort of begged them to death, and eventually did do something while she was on contract to them. And eventually she actually broke her contract, and it got into a bit of a battle where she sued them. I was quite she
Wow.
was quite just on the comment of the girl that dates Frank Sinatra and Elvis Presley.
Yeah.
She did have a lot of like a definite backbone and a lot of balls, actually. And so she sued 20th Century Fox. Essentially because she was on the Perry Como show and they didn't want to pay her the amount that she earned on it, because she was on contract to them and things like that. They didn't want to pay her for the stage production, Irma La Douce, exactly what she earned in Vegas. Long and short of what happened is they then wanted to deport her because she was South African, and then she started her own company and then produced her own act. That was the first thing she produced. And she didn't focus on film. From that breakup with 20th Century Fox, she focused on a live act, and also proving to really everyone that she was more than Frank Sinatra's girlfriend,
Right.
because that ended as well. So
Right. That could
that's
be.
sort of that impacted on her, let's say, her movie career. A couple of things that didn't make for a good movie career as such.
Yeah, that could be a real trap that you fall into is if you become famous for dating much more famous men, then that's what the America thinks what that, oh, you know, they don't think of you as your own person. That's the woman that dated Frank Sinatra and Elvis Presley. But you go,
Yes.
okay, yes, but I have my own life. It just happened to be dating these two of the most famous people of the 20th century. One other thing I wanted to ask you, kind of related to the book, before we kind of talk about her film career, is you mentioned all of these newspaper clips that you found, all these articles and all this stuff. Was that stuff that she collected? Like, did she kind of archive this stuff? Some famous people take great care to keep track of all that. They may not tell people that they're doing it, but they are doing it. And then there's this trove of stuff, and other people don't bother with it at all. So, was this stuff that she collected, which would indicate she was sort of aware of her own fame and keeping track of it for you to use later on? Or was this material that other people collected that you just then you got a hold of?
The situation, I'd say, was a young girl, great relationship with her mother, my grandmother, and she's off overseas and she's doing all these wonderful things, and she's sending back newspaper articles of, "Oh, look what I did," and writing numerous letters. In the beginning, she was writing almost once a week, because
Wow.
possibly here as well. So it was just some of them were sent, I'd say, by her, and then I could tell that some of them were sent by the PR agency to her, just by this. So they were in my grandmother's. They were in her possession. And I haven't got a sense for my, as I said, my she had one son, my cousin Seth, who lives in California. I don't have a sense that he has a huge file of them because went to his house as well in when I was doing all this research, and it's more that he has old he her her Bob Mackie costumes, her
Wow.
costumes that she used in Vegas. He's still got those. But
Wow.
the newspaper articles were for my grandmother to see how her only daughter was doing.
Sure, of course.
And being able to sort of participate in, they had a very close relationship. It was a very sort of sweet relationship, and very supportive, my grandmother, of her dreams.
Oh, that's great. I mean, again, you send your daughter off to America, and then all of a sudden Nikita Khrushchev is talking about her. Like, what? What is happening? That's like who has a life like that? It's just absolutely amazing. So, okay.
I'll tell you this on the one letter when she writes, and it's about dating Sinatra, and she says to her mother, I hope you'll be okay with this. He is 21 years older than me.
Was grandma, in fact, okay with it,
Oh,
or?
she was actually quite savvy, my grandmother, because she sort of became the South African press office. The media would sort of flood her, their house and stuff like that. And she once made a comment. I can't remember if this was when it didn't work, the relationship, the engagement ended. But she sort of said, Juliet is big enough to sort out her own life. And Juliet
Wow.
was about 23 or 25. There was something I read which I realized this really typified, it just illustrated Juliet as a character and my grandmother as her mother. She was 12 years old when her dance teacher said she couldn't teach her anymore. She's very talented and she needed to go an hour away to the big city in South Africa, Johannesburg.
Wow.
And Juliet persuaded her mother that she was worthy enough to go on her own by bus. And it was bus and another bus and a ballet class and another bus and then staying at some friends' houses for the house for the night.
Wow.
And I thought, okay, that tells you something about both of them
Yes.
and how grandmother let her live her dream. And yeah, and then that's how it continued for the rest of their lives.
That's amazing. That's just absolutely amazing. So, okay.
Yeah.
So, well, let's talk about Can-Can a little bit. It said it's she was in apparently she, on her IMDb. There are two other movies that are listed that she appears uncredited as a dancer, and one of them I've seen and I couldn't spot her in those, so I was like, okay, but let's Can-Can is where you see her.
Yes.
And based on the musical, the Broadway musical, and the thing I learned about before watching the film and then going watching it was on Broadway, the role that would eventually go to your aunt, Claudine, is much bigger on Broadway. The role was played by Ben Vernon, and it was a much, much bigger role. And then they came to make the movie. Shirley MacLaine gets cast, and Shirley MacLaine has enough power in the role
Yes.
to ask the studio to basically take her character and the Claudine character and sort of smoosh them together so she gets a lot more to do, which
Yes.
leaves the Claudine character with not much to do. So Juliet Prowse is in the movie and she dances wonderfully, and she gets to do the famous line about pointing her butt at Frank Sinatra. But other than that, and she has basically one scene where she's acting with Sinatra, but other than that, she's just kind of a she's clearly the lead dancer once the dancers come out. But other than that, she doesn't get a lot to do, which had to be frustrating to land the role and then have it kind of written out from under you.
So interestingly, the role that was offered to her was principal dancer. So
Okay.
it wasn't meant to have a speaking aspect to it,
Oh,
although.
okay. Okay.
So she comes over and meets the producer, and then gets offered a small speaking part. And because
Okay.
she was so she was inexperienced and just trying to get opportunities. She actually wrote to her mother and was very excited. She called her, I've been upgraded to second leading lady. And she has a small speaking part. But I think that the fact that Shirley MacLaine, the fact that that happened to the role was not frustrating for Juliet because it had already been adapted by then,
Right.
you know. So no, Juliet, everything was new and fresh, and she was very excited about everything, meeting famous people and and working in and just seeing how much money was being poured into the production.
A
She
huge
hadn't.
production, huge, huge, huge production. So yeah, she at the end there's an end dance number where they do a kind of an Adam and Eve thing, and Juliet pl is as Claudine plays the snake, and she's in this kind of headgear, and she's in all green, and it's sort of she's like she's sort of like a sexy xenomorph from the Alien movies. Like it's kind of it's not meant to be necessarily sexy, but it is because the way she's slinking around in the trees and stuff. So you're like, wow, okay.
I think Juliet, I mean, she worked a lot with a choreographer called Tony Shalhoub, like in on a variety of shows and different things. And he once made a comment. He worked with her literally from almost the beginning. And so this was like 4 years later or something like that. He was doing something for the Danny Kaye show, I think. And he said, "I'm just doing a soft, lyrical number for her. Juliet is so sexy, and some people resent that. So, or like, I'm not going to play on that because she's so sexy anyway, and not everyone enjoys that or something like
So her next
Yeah.
film is GI Blues with Elvis Presley, and for I watched a lot of the Elvis movies, and one of the things that I found curious and a little frustrating about some of them, the later ones where they kind of really got into a formula where there's kind of very little drama, there's very little stakes, it's just kind of, Elvis is going to sing some songs and there's going to be some minor conflict and he's going to hug a few girls and that's kind of it. Is a lot of his leading ladies are very bland. I hate to be mean about it, but a lot of them are just very, very bland on-screen presences. And it seems very strange to me that they would constantly kind of give these sort of dull performers or at the, you know what, let me be more, the roles as written are pretty dull to pair up against one of the most dynamic figures, again, of the 20th century. That is not the case in GI Blues. Now, I think the movie is kind of okay because, again, it's just sort of, there's not a lot of stakes and the songs. I don't find the songs to be super memorable. But when Julian enters the picture and she's playing up against Elvis, she kind of like what I alluded to earlier about having a steel spine. She is his equal when she's on screen with him. She doesn't get a lot to do again because it's an Elvis picture, but she is one of, I'd say, his few leading ladies that sort of his level, which was kind of a nice change of pace for all the other Elvis movies I was watching.
So obviously he was like far better well known and before he went to the army. And so for Juliet, that was her first leading role. And I think what helped it is that they quite quickly like started hanging out and enjoying each other, and he was 2 years older than her instead of Sinatra's 21.
Wow.
And Sinatra was off on a world tour, and so she just had a lot of fun, and there was chemistry, and really enjoyed him. So I think she found him very sweet and lovely, and he had said to her that he was crazy about her, and I think that helped Juliet just relax and enjoy the role. I do think her dance scenes are, it was lovely for that to get captured on film. Just some of her scenes and how effortless she makes them. So just quite a fun movie. As far as the fact that she's not really known as a movie star, I kind of that's probably the her, that is her biggest role, or probably more well known just because of it's an Elvis movie,
It's right. It's forever going to be historical because it stars arguably the most famous person of the 20th century. So yeah. But yeah, and it's, I mean, any and most of the actresses that had to play opposite Elvis, the role was always they reject Elvis and then he works on them and then they fall in love with Elvis. Like that's kind of the three act structure. And some of the actresses were able to transcend that a little bit and some were not. And I think she has kind of a, maybe it's by the dint of her accent, which I felt was kind of nice. Like she didn't really try and hide it, which was nice. You know, they didn't force that on her, you know, to kind of make her sound like quote unquote American or anything like that. But she's
Yes.
got this slight flinty spin on her line reads. And maybe because you said she wasn't a trained actor, maybe that's her personality coming out. And maybe if she had studied extensively with actor, like an acting teacher, maybe that acting teacher would have like, you know, drum that out of her. So it's good that she didn't have it. So she just has like a, she looks like she's kind of no, there's something, maybe I'm reading into it or something, but there's something in her face that seems like she kind of knows all of this is very silly. And there's something about that. You know what I mean? Like she kind of is like, okay, yeah, Elvis, okay, let's just have fun. There's just something about her. Some actors have that look to them. It's, and it, they're not denigrating the material. I don't mean that. It's just, they kind of look like they know in their eye. They have this intelligence in their eyes. I'm like, all right, I kind of know. All right, I know what I got to do. All right, Elvis. But in the meanwhile, I'm going to do this great dance number by myself. Again, she gets these dance numbers as a solo, which a lot of the leading ladies in Elvis movies didn't get to do. They were just there to play off against Elvis, and then they sort of disappear. So anyway, after that, she does those two movies that we talked about that are just The Right Approach and The Fiercest Heart, which are just impossible to find, is very frustrating.
Yes.
I just, in this modern age of streaming, I'm like, they've got to be available somewhere, and they just are not. So it's just really, really frustrating. Then she does this Western. She's like fifth lead in this comedy Western with Debbie Reynolds called The Second Time Around, which.
That was like, just I think it was like a it was when the 20th Century Fox relationship was sort of crumbling or scratchy
Okay.
and please let me do anything kind of.
Okay.
And then she knew Debbie Reynolds from being from socializing with Frank Sinatra and those with
Right,
with
of
Debbie
course.
was still
Sure.
married to Eddie Fisher.
Right.
Yeah, I think it was just please let me work. I want to do anything. Just please let me work.
I actually kind of like that movie. It's a little too long for how slight it is, and it's very silly. But it's like an hour and 40 something minutes, which is maybe a little too long for something as sort of frivolous as this. But I actually kind of like it. You can find it on YouTube and stuff. Thelma Ritter is in it, who I absolutely adore. And Juliette Prowse gets to stab a guy in the butt, which is nice, right? That's there's a scene where these cowboys start punching one of the heroes in this candy. There's like this candy store. And of course, all the women are scatter because they don't want to get hit. And then one guy turns and she literally pulls like a needle out from something and just stabs him in the ass, which I thought, wow, okay. This is like 1964. That's kind of ahead of its time a little bit. I was like, it's okay. That's cool. Then she was in this movie called Run for Your Wife, which was an Italian production, which I had a rough time with this one, I have to say, because it was one of those movies. It's one of those movies of like, oh, Italian men cheating their wives, and that's funny.
The
All
funny
right,
thing
is
about
it?
and the funny thing about looking at that movie means it her the English version is not her voice. So that was really funny for me. I was
Yep.
like, what? Oh. It was just weird,
Yeah. It's a, yeah. And I it's Ugo Tognazzi is the star of it. And yeah, she's only, she, it's a guy who has multiple. He meets multiple women in America. He has a wife back in Italy, and he has multiple women. And yeah, I'm sure it was funny in 1966, but or 64, whenever it was made. But I was like, I just kind of sat there like, okay, all right.
No, one thing I just wanted to add just on her career, because I haven't mentioned this and it happened. She about in 61, so she got offered a second Elvis movie.
Oh.
She got offered a movie Blue Hawaii.
Okay.
And I think this possibly, I mean, generally her frustrations with 20th Century Fox were one thing, but this might have also had you created, well, it did create a reaction, and I put it in the book. So she didn't feel she felt the role was more inferior was inferior to the GI Blues role. So
Okay.
that kind of frustrated her and she wanted it expanded. But then she also wanted her friend to come with her on they were filming in Hawaii. So she asked kind of for her own makeup artist so that her friend could come with her. Or just, and then there was like a disagreement and she didn't accept the role as such. So
Huh.
she got suspended because of that.
Wow.
And
Wow.
She not only got suspended, but she'd have other producers walk past and just yell at her in a restaurant. One of them said something like, "Who do you think you are? One good film behind you, and now you think you're something, and everyone around you know nothing." And so I don't think that helped her career. She believed in she didn't she wanted to try and get better roles, which then didn't really happen as such.
Wow. Okay. Geez. You can see the logic, though. You can totally see the logic of like, well, I just don't want to be the girl in the Elvis movies. So, you know, that's I you I could totally could see that, especially that one's even slighter than GI Blues is. That's interesting. So then she does this movie in South Africa, Dingaka, which is I assume did it mostly so she could go home and shoot a movie at home. I have to assume that's why she would do, because she doesn't sing or dance. It's not that kind of movie. It's like a courtroom drama, set in again in South apart it's in apartheid South Africa at the time. But I have to assume that she did it mostly because she gets to go home.
My sense, without knowing the really reason why, is yes, possibly it was at home. I don't think she was getting a lot of movie roles,
Right.
so that was what I concluded. So, I mean, the director, not at the time, but he actually became a well-known director. He had a movie that did very well, and I watched that the other day, just more in preparation for any film podcasts. And I mean, it took ages before she even came into the movie.
Yeah,
You were
it's like a
really
half hour before she shows up.
The film didn't really particularly do very well. I could see why. The theme was quite heavy throughout,
Yeah.
I felt.
There's a scene in that movie, though, where she's at a party with her husband, and it's like a black tie party, and their doctor is there, and it's at the party that he tells her that she's pregnant. I'm like, the world, and she's happy. She's like, oh, thank you for telling me. Like, I don't know, maybe that's a little unprofessional, or waiting till a party to tell me this very important piece of news. Like, oh well, things were very, very different back then. So okay. So anyway, so then she does this movie, Who Killed Teddy Bear, which again, unusual title. The poster for it, if you find it, you can see it on IMDb. An amazing poster. Juliet is central to the poster, but it's a beautiful poster, very captivating. It was released on December 8th, 1965. I'm not going to get into too far details into the plot, but here's a little bit of the overview of what it's about. So, aspiring actress and nighttime disc jockey Nora Dane starts receiving obscene phone calls from someone who is claiming he is watching her. Things escalate when she finds a decapitated teddy bear in her apartment, so she contacts the police. The case is taken up by Lieutenant Dave Madden, whose own wife was raped and murdered. Madden takes a very intense interest in the case and then Nora herself. He goes so far as to listen to audio tapes of sexual assault victims telling their stories within earshot of his young daughter. We soon learn that the voyeur is Lawrence, a waiter at the club where Nora works. Lawrence lives with his mentally challenged sister, who has the mind of a child, thanks to an accident that he blames himself for. Nora, not knowing Lawrence is her stalker, befriends him, leading to an escalation of his obsession. Juliet Prowse plays Nora, Sal Mineo plays Lawrence, Jan Murray plays Lieutenant Dave Madden, and Elaine Stritch plays Marion, the owner of the club that Nora works at. The film is directed by Joseph Cates, who did a really terrible movie called The Fat Spy, a 1980 special Steve Martin TV special. The movie was co-written by two men. One was named Leon Talkatayan, who mostly did television, and then co-written by the other guy is named Arnold Drake. And for a lot of the people who listen to this show who are big comic book fans, because the Fire and Water Podcast Network does all the comic book stuff, they know that name. Arnold Drake is more famous as a comic book creator. He co-created the Doom Patrol. He co-created Deadman. He co-created the original Guardians of the Galaxy. He has two TV, he has two film script credits, and this is one of them. So it's bewildering that a person that I knew of from reading so many of his comic books co-wrote this movie. It's very, very strange. This is a really odd film so far ahead of its time. And I have to ask you, Julia, when did you see this? Because I can only imagine seeing your aunt in this movie had to be off-putting because it is a gritty, dark movie.
So we did not know about this movie really, and I only really in doing the research for the book for that was the first time I started
Oh, wow.
watching.
Okay.
I mean, I interestingly, besides the fact that South Africa only got television in like about 1976, I didn't realize that this movie didn't get a rating or a certificate in the UK until 2009. So it
Wow.
really so getting it released in South Africa, you know, that would I don't think that would ever be impossible. It'd ever be possible with the nature of the content and how the apartheid government try to control things. So really, it was really as after her death and me researching the book that I sort of watched this movie. And what I found quite interesting is really the departure, let's say for Juliet, as you said, is it Arnold Drake, the fact that he is writing this kind of script seems really a departure for him. The role is really a quite a serious, dramatic role, and Juliet at the time was you know she did the breakaway from 20th Century Fox and was on stage and in musical theatre and her roles on stage were all she satirized famous women so you could see her sort of comedic side, and then she does this role which is really quite. Which is a serious, it's a serious role. I'd say I think what I find fascinating about the movie is on one hand, at the time it was viewed as kind of a too progressive, kind of creepy, you know, yet, and I don't know, it was even in the 60s, but certainly the film is still being shown, and even today, I actually had a chat earlier this week to the director's grandson.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Just to get some of his take because Juliet doesn't talk about it much in her letters, and she didn't talk about it much at all.
Okay.
You know, we didn't get anything from her, but according to so Joseph Kate's grandson is Owen Klein. He said actually the movie was meant to just was not meant to have any sort of big stars in it at all. It was sort of meant to be you know this I think the elements that make it a long lasting film or film among you know sort of being a cult film is sort of its gritty filming in New York and also some of a lot of the movie and its suggestive topics, or not even suggestive, but and it was only that when Sal Mineo got involved that some of the other people started getting involved. But it wasn't intended to be a movie with any well-known stars, and Sal certainly was well known at that point. You know, two Academy nominations by that point. I think the other departure for Sal, my understanding of his career, is he was wanting to move away from this troubled teen angst kind of role that he'd played before, but it didn't. I don't think this movie did really much for Juliet's career, you know, into making into a dramatic actress.
It's
And
a gutsy
Sal.
movie for her to take for someone who's not, who, as you talked about, not a trained actor, but her now had been in movies for just 5 or 6 years. It's a really, really gutsy movie for her to take. And in movies, I always feel like movies deserve to be viewed, if you can, in the context they were made. And so if this movie had been made in 1975, it wouldn't be that remarkable because by 75, a lot of these topics were, could be talked about with the rating system had come in and you could cover. But 1965,
Yes.
that is way ahead of the curve. I mean, first of all, I mentioned Elaine Stritch, the great Elaine Stritch, who I really know mostly from playing Alec Baldwin's mother on 30 Rock, which is brilliant on that. She plays the owner of the nightclub that Juliette Prowse's character works at, and there's they she invites her back to her apartment, and then Elaine Stritch's character Marion basically puts the move
Yes.
on Nora, and it's startling because you're just not expecting it for a movie made in 1965. Now, as you mentioned, these are not big stars, but they're not no names either. This was, the movie had some level of production value, and Sal Mineo, as you mentioned, had been not nominated for a couple of Oscars by that point, in Rebel Without a Cause and Exodus and things like that. So this was not a nothing production, and to see people that you're somewhat are somewhat famous on different levels being in this movie is really startling, really startling. And you're just, I kept thinking, this was made in 1965. Where did they expect this to even be shown? Because the Sal Mineo character looks at pornography, and there's an extensive scene where he wanders the streets of New York going to porno theaters and buying porno magazines. And this clearly, the movie did not have to, they didn't have the budget to set all this up. This is just real. This is just, they just sent Sal Mineo out on the street. And there's even a moment where he stops, his character stops and buys a ticket at a porno theater. And it's clearly a real porno theater. And right at that moment, you see a family walk by with small children. And I guarantee that's a real family on vacation in New York. And maybe the family's like, hey, look at that. That's Sal Mineo. Oh, what is he doing? He's buying tickets for a porno film. And you see these little kids, and you're like, there's some kid like my age who was like, oh yeah, I think I'm in 2 seconds of that movie or something, if they even know. And so it's kind of funny that he thought this movie would get him away from his troubled characters. Dear Lord, this guy's nothing but trouble. But Juliet is, I'd say, really good in it for someone who has to play the victim throughout the film, because she's the victim of Sal Mineo's ministrations. And then she kind of becomes the victim of Jan Murray's Lieutenant Dave Madden, who completely inappropriately gets obsessed with her on a personal level. And but she stands firm throughout the film. Like, she's really good in it.
I because I knew she'd once made a comment, just going back to Can-Can and G.I. Blues. So when she was much older, she was asked about those films, and she sort of goes, "Oh, I was trained for the theater, and I wasn't trained to do movies." So she feels like she actually feels like she's overacting. In her later comments. So yeah, doing this very serious role in Who Killed Teddy Bear, I've sort of tried to see what the critics said about her, and I think they did. There were compliments about her playing the seriousness of the role and sort of keeping the tension that existed. Well, it wasn't only with the Sal Mineo character, but the detective. That was also I kind of laughed at that, because you don't often see that, I think, in current crime thrillers. That's probably my favorite genre, where the detective seems to be slightly obsessed with his with the person he's supposed to be helping.
I mean, he makes
The
these weird comments about, he's like, well, I could be the one who's stalking you. You're like, what? Why would you say what? And again, it is, I have seen a lot of these kinds of movies. Certainly not one as sort of sordid as this one, which again made it pop a little bit. First of all, it's her only black and white film after doing nothing but color films. Here's a film coming after all those, and it's in black and
Yes.
white. But like, I think it can be easy for an actor who is playing a victim in the script to just come across as weak and just the victim. Like, they don't really have much of a character. They're just there to be the victim of the plot. And that happens sometimes in lesser thrillers. I don't think that happens here, even though she is the victim of a great, especially near the end of the film where she gets assaulted. But she manages to hold her own, and I think that says something about. And I don't mean to disparage Joseph Cates. I'm not really familiar with his filmography outside of, like I mentioned, The Fat Spy, which I thought was just a terrible movie. I don't get the sense that she was probably given a lot of direction on how to perform her role, but she is the lead in the movie. Yes, Lawrence is the antagonist, but she is the lead of the film. And it made me think, boy, it would have been interesting to see what she could have done in other movies
Yes.
like this going forward, maybe bigger productions, but she's, like I mentioned, she's really quite good in this.
Thank you. I do. I did. You know, I'm obviously looking at a family member that I love
Sure.
dearly. I did actually think she did the role. You know, yeah, I was quite comfortable with how she performed.
Yeah.
I mean, an interesting just another reality that impacted on her career is that she was often compared to Leslie Caron, who was the French actress.
Right.
And I, so
G.
I do think, yes, I do think that Juliet could have got more roles, but there were just other people around that were getting the roles.
Right.
So a Leslie Caron or a Shirley MacLaine, you know, and yeah, I think this was a good dramatic role for her. And she could have got more. What happened after that is that she got the or now I'm trying to think of the dates. It was actually just before that was or she was filming Mona McCluskey, so she
Okay.
was filming a TV series, and then she got the role on stage in Las Vegas and then in London in Sweet Charity.
Okay.
So she, as far as kind of what happened in her career, is that she immediately after this. Well, not immediately. She was on stage for a couple of years, and didn't have the time or space to do any to consider any movie roles.
Gotcha. I'm all, yeah,
Yeah, just
I'm
to
always
build.
curious. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No. The concept of trying to build a career and having a next opportunity. She went to stage and she was on stage for 2 years, basically.
I'm always curious about when, an actor, if they know something is their final film, are they are they comfortable with that, knowing that's their, and maybe some actors don't even think of it that way. Some actors probably look at their entirety of their career as well. It's all one big thing. I did some movies, I did some television, I did some stage. And when she did as many things as she did, it, she's not thinking of herself as a film actor the way some people do. Like Tom Cruise clearly is like, I'm a film actor. I only do movies, I don't do television. But she did lots of things. So she probably was just like, okay, I have other projects I want to do. I'm not worrying about that. She's not thinking in the context of, well, Who Killed Teddy Bear is my last movie. I'm not thinking like that. It's only
No.
in retrospect that you go back and you say, but it is when you look at her filmography, as I did when we decided to do this, you're like, wow, what a hard right turn, right? To be in these movies, to kind of be in these studio productions and then earn, this thing over here. Like, wow, what a strange, what a strange, dark, gritty movie for Juliet Prowse to be in.
Yes.
She continues on and continues on in Broadway and television. And I want to get back to how we opened it was The Muppet Show. Because, like I said, when I was a kid, I was a little kid, I watched The Muppet Show regularly. And when you're a kid, you have a sense of who is a famous person. Well, being on The Muppet Show just meant you were a famous person. That's just what it meant. And the fact that she not only does she host, I mentioned, she mentions she hosts the first episode, which I would argue takes guts because you don't know what they're, you're not sure, do they know what they're doing? You know what I mean? Like you can imagine that maybe doing the Muppet Show 6 episodes in or a year in, you're like, well, now that I've seen the show, I know how it works. They've clearly got it and they know what they're doing, are the puppets. And but I mean, to do the first one, that takes quite a bit of just personal guts to say, I'm gonna put myself over to the Jim Henson and these productions, and hopefully it'll come off. And then in that episode, she has a dance number with these kind of Mumenschanz type puppets. And it's really quite beautiful. And one of the things that makes the Muppet Show so iconic and timeless is that her dance number in the middle of it is not meant to be funny. It's not, it's a straight ahead dance number. The other bits are funny, but the dance number is just, this is just a dance number that we're going to put in front of children. And it's really quite beautiful.
So I actually found that in researching the Muppets, basically, obviously Jim Henson came up with the idea, but he couldn't get an American producer at
No, right.
first.
You had to go to England. Yeah.
He had to go to England. So yes, she's, but because Juliet is doing things on either she's doing things in London and then, going back and forth between, let's say, London and the US, I think she just was. She by that stage she'd really, I think, built her career, knew what she was as a dancer. In that she was almost 40 at that time. It was not, I think it was 1970s. I'm not
Six.
sure, 76. So I think she'd been on so many different shows and had her own show in Las Vegas, and so for her, it would have been, I think, quite easy to do. I always seemed like quite an easy decision to go on it. I did watch that dance and I thought, because it was pitched as adult sketch comedy, and I thought you could have done a cheekier dance than that. I mean, Juliet has a fabulous sense of humor. She started her nightclub career with satirizing women and getting she they were quite cheeky. In some of the things that she satirized and some of the songs that were created for her by actually Sinatra's lyricist, composer and lyricist. So you could have taken Juliet and just made something cheeky. But I know, yeah, so I was like curious how they decided that, it was a Scott Joplin song. And Juliet herself says in her letter to my grandmother, she says about that, "It's not really me, and I only really get into it towards the end." So I think because it's soft and beautiful, it's this lovely dance, and it does show for dance a talent. But I was like, you could have used her humor. She's so comedic, you could have done more of that. I mean, there's a scene. I don't know if it's. I think it's in the same episode with the scarf. I don't know if you saw that one
Yes,
where
yes.
she and her, the. I mean, that's as children. That's classic Juliet pulling her face when she's when it turns into a creature. So yeah. I did when I realized it was the first episode. I was like, once again, that was one another thing that was like, oh, she really was, big.
Yeah, it said
Yeah.
it's and the Muppet Show for, as a list of hosts. They definitely tried to introduce children to figures that most children would not know. I mean,
Think it was meant for children though, initially. It
well, I mean,
was
well, yes, true.
adult sketch comedy.
That is true.
Well,
But I mean, they had to know children were watching the Muppet Show. I mean, it's Muppets. I mean, they had to know that. I mean, I watched it religiously, but just having. Again, you look at their list of hosts, and it's like it's not your typical kind of Love Boat, collection of TV stars. It's again, it's Vincent Price and like Mark Hamill and Mikhail Baryshnikov and Juliet Prowse and Debbie Harry. You're like, what an eclectic mix of people. So I just found that so charming to go back and revisit that because, like I said, when I was a kid, I knew the name Juliet Prowse from, oh, she was a dancer. Oh, she was on the Muppet Show. That's how I knew her. It was just that was a name that I knew from being 6 years old. I've known her for, I've known who she is for 4 decades since. And so, thanks to Jim Henson for thinking to and put her in the very first episode. So there's one other thing I have to ask when I saw on her Wikipedia page, and not everything on a Wikipedia page is correct, but
No, I've tried to change it, by the way. I get shot down. I'm
really.
too close to it. It's interesting. I've tried more than once to change the things that are incorrect. Then I gave up,
Okay.
basically.
But I have to, and I'm sorry, this is kind of like nasty. This is kind of, but it jumped out of me. In 1987, Juliet Prowse was mauled by the same 80-pound leopard on two occasions. The first time while filming a scene for Circus of the Stars, then later while rehearsing a promotional stunt for The Tonight Show. The later attack was more serious, requiring upwards of 20 stitches to reattach her ear. Is that accurate? Did that really happen?
That's absolutely accurate.
Oh my
So,
Lord.
and I because I, so I was in the US as a student when all of this happened. And so she was doing, a big cat act on Circus of the Stars, and there was one particular leopard that. So I ended up meeting a bunch of people when I went to the US to chat and get stories about her, and I met the costume designer who had originally performed with Juliet in Silk Stockings back in the early 60s, and he then became I think an award-winning costume designer. And he said he originally designed something with big discs on them, so when she
Okay.
moved to the top, it actually made a noise. And this
Oh.
leopard didn't like that at all, so he changed that quickly. And the newspaper articles that I've read about it, basically, when she first got attacked, everyone went into sort of like panic, and the producer said she was actually probably the calmest person there. And the second time
Wow.
was on the Johnny Carson show. And my aunt said, Juliet said it was either the lights or the mirrors or something about his set. So
Was there one working leopard in all of Hollywood? Why? How could it
I
be the same one?
know. I got to tell you about this is very personal to me, but I have a picture in my house of Juliet that I didn't know existed until let's say 10 years ago, and I wanted to pair it with another picture, and I found one. It's a Vogue cover from 1939, and it has a woman with a leopard jacket on.
Oh.
It's not Juliet, obviously. She's not
Right.
she. She would have been three then, and it's actually just an illustration of a lady. The coat is up to here, and her eyes are beautifully done. And I thought, that's perfect. That just reminds me of her,
Oh my.
a leopard coat.
That's just one of those factoids you see, and you're like, wait, old Hollywood was just very different a couple of decades ago. Just the idea, you would never read of that today. And well, first of all, thank God we don't put leopards on television because they don't belong on television. They don't like the lights. They don't, just leave them alone. Leave the animals alone for Pete's sake. But the idea that it was the same leopard is just like, what? How is that possible?
It happened.
Okay. The things you put
She
up with
wasn't
to have
just
them.
like she was at a stage of her career, so she would have been a 50. Is that right? 51 then? No, I haven't got that. Yeah, sorry. Yes. So she actually was. She performed and she was still dancing, but the bulk of the really what she did a whole career, she couldn't do that kind of dancing anymore. So
Sure.
she was doing some dancing. But not nearly at the same level, not nearly she not at the same level at all. So she would take some of these shows that came along and then
Oof. It was crazy. It was just a crazy, crazy thing. And what you have to put up with sometimes to have a show business career. So,
yes.
well, Juliette, thank you so much for doing this. This is, like I mentioned, like Juliette Prowse was a name that I always knew. I've known my whole life, and I knew she was in some movies, but I knew her just from her television work. And it was a real pleasure to kind of go back in and read about her and see. Watch her film career, even though it was sort of, shorter than she would have wanted it to be, and didn't quite work out the way she wanted it to, but that's kind of the way it works sometimes in Hollywood. Sometimes you go on to the huge things and sometimes you don't, and you do good work and other times you don't. And I'm glad I got to see the movie she was in, especially Who Killed Teddy Bear, which again, not for everybody, not a film for everybody, but definitely interesting, and could have been an indicator of what she was capable of if that had worked out. So, but to end this, we always end the show with an exit question, and so I'm going to end something a little more fanciful in that. We talked about that maybe had she come around 10 years earlier or 10 years later, it might have been different. I could see her in all that jazz, like I could sort of see her fitting in that sort of thing. So. For you, is there a classic musical that you think we could go back in the time machine that you would have liked to have seen your aunt appear in?
So I think, as I said earlier, like the musicals that were in the 1950s, I think the one that it would have been wonderful, a Gene Kelly movie called An American in Paris, which
Okay.
happened to have Leslie Caron in it.
Yep.
It's more to illustrate to her level of her ability to dance. her dancing and her I think that would have been a lovely movie. I also have been thinking about this question. She loved Sweet Charity as a character. It was good for her, and she did. So Gwen Verdon did it on Broadway, and then Juliet did it in Las Vegas for 6 months, and then also went and did it in London. And in writing the book, the studios felt that Shirley MacLaine was really the best, and the for the TV the movie. But I think that there was one sort of let's say journalist, gossip columnist that absolutely loved my aunt, and she sort of made a like a little comment, and it was something like, "No wonder the movie bombed, Juliet should have played her."
It's again Shirley MacLaine.
Yes. I think, I mean, Shirley was very much a contemporary, and they did quite a lot. They were in each other's lives. Shirley MacLaine was actually at Juliet's memorial service when she died.
Oh, what? Oh, wow.
Yeah. So that's more like just because Juliet loved that role. But I think of a dancing role, an American in Paris, and playing the person she was compared to a lot, as far as
Gotcha.
looks. So
All right.
yeah, I think yeah, it's unfortunate that she wasn't born just a little earlier than she would have got a role. But I'm sure a lot of the dancers, it might, feel. I know Bob Fosse felt the same as well. So
Right.
it's just what happens. You've got to work within the what's possible for you in the moment, in the years of your performance.
Absolutely. So, well, why don't you tell people where they can? I mean, obviously they can get the book on Amazon and stuff like that, but where they can learn? I know you have a website for the book. Where tell people where they can find and learn more about your aunt and the book.
Yeah, so the book is, I'll just do it like that, it is available in hard copy as well as an ebook, and it's on a lot of platforms as an ebook. It's on as a hard copy, it's on Amazon and Barnes and Noble. I'm trying to think. But ebook, it's Apple and all sorts of platforms. I have part of the project, I call it, because it started with the book, is also to try and get a lot of her live performance onto YouTube. So there is a YouTube channel that I'm sort of loading performances. And then yeah, there's a Facebook page, and I've also got a website. Obviously, we share the same name, so I can just make it one name. Then it's kind of about both of us. So yeah, I hope people, if they want to, it's a mixture of her career and her romantic life. It has to be, because she had such a fun, a fun romantic life as well, or an interesting romantic life.
Big life, a big life,
A big life.
undoubtedly, undoubtedly. And
Yeah.
it's great to have the YouTube archive. That's wonderful. It's kind of amazing over time for those of us old enough to, predate YouTube, that like YouTube has gone from this kind of random scattershot thing to where now someone like you can create a channel and it can become a permanent archive of
Yes.
what her work was. I mean, it's one thing to have it in a museum somewhere that, in New York, where like, okay, but most people can't, go to New York and look at this stuff, and I mean, the Museum of the Moving Image or whatever. I mean, that stuff's great, but it's 99% of people aren't going to be able to do that. So it's great to be able to say, hey, I'm now going to compile all the various things that my aunt did that might have been lost to time, and now they're all be in one place, or theater performances, or TV performances, movie. That's a wonderful thing to be able to have.
Yes, I wanted to, I as I said, my only aunt, my I'm named after her, and so I wanted to do this for her.
Well, thank you so much for
Thank
doing
you.
this. I really appreciate it. It was a wonderful conversation. I loved learning more about your aunt, and it was really enjoyable talking about her career with you.
Thank you so much. Thank
So,
you.
all right. So, thank you all for listening. Of course, you can find all the back episodes of the show on FryandWaterPodcast.com. Subscribe to the show on any podcatcher of your choice. You can find us on Blue Sky at Fade Out Pod. And if you want to support the Fry and Water Podcast Network, please just go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. There you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So, big thanks to Monique D., Donald McWaters, Mark Balbus, plus David A.S. Gutierrez, Gord Tolton, Al and Mike Atchison for their support of Fade Out and the Fry and Water Podcast Network. And then special thanks to Professor Chuck Coletta. guest on this show who put me and Juliet together. I wasn't aware of the book. Now we know. Now we have an episode. So thank you so much, Chuck, for playing matchmaker like that. I really appreciate it. So, and thank you all for listening. We'll be back with another episode next month, but we've reached the end of this particular skit. So for now, it's time to fade out.
Johannesburg theatre audiences had the opportunity of seeing South Africa's most famous film star, Juliet Prowse. On a short visit to her parents, following the announcement of her engagement to Frank Sinatra, Juliet received a tremendous ovation when she stepped onto the stage at the Coliseum to make a personal appearance. She faced a microphone interview with a natural self-assurance which endeared her to the audience, and said that her famous fiancé has every hope of visiting us in the not-too-distant future. The same evening, she made a personal appearance at the 20th Century Theatre, and once again received a welcoming ovation. Juliet Prowse wished she could spend longer back in her home country, but has professional commitments which even she can't twist out of.